Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. According to Realtor.com, the average age of the first-time homebuyer is 40 years old, a record high. Skyrocketing home prices and limited housing stock have turned the dream of home ownership for many into a nightmare. The Trump administration is floating an idea to help making home buying easier, a 50-year mortgage. However, fellow Republicans and financial experts have their doubts. Tommy Aiello is the Senior Director of Government Affairs for the National Taxpayers Union, a nonpartisan anti-tax advocacy group. Welcome to All Sides, Tommy.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So how would a 50-year mortgage work versus the 30-year mortgage that we're all used to?
You know, let's just take a step back and see why we're having this conversation, right? I think all Americans agree, regardless of your politics, that the rent's too high, homes are too expensive, and people are falling behind. We see that in the data, and you just pointed out that the average first-time homebuyer is 40 years old. That creates a lot of pessimism for the younger generations, including in my generation, that we're falling behind and unable to get ahead. And that's what the president recognizes, and his team wants to come up with very creative ways to help solve the problem. You know, the 50-year mortgage, it sounds good on paper, but if you dive into the details, people are going to pay more, they're going to pay longer, and they're going to be trapped in debt for longer. We think we need to actually identify and solve the root problems of the housing problem rather than just, creative ideas that ultimately won't help people at the end of the day.
Now, this 50-year mortgage is getting a lot of buzz. The idea is that you'll save a couple of $100 a month, and that's appealing on your monthly mortgage payment. But the flip side of that is paying an extra 20 years of interest above that 30-year mortgage. So that might not be as appealing. What's the short-term versus the long-term idea for you?
You know, it's certainly a mixed bag for potential home buyers. We ran some of the numbers, and, if you're purchasing an average home of $400,000, you might say, compared to a 50-year mortgage, compared to a 30-year mortgage, you might save about $250 a month. And that's a lot of money for a lot of people, right? That's 2 weeks worth of groceries or maybe a month's worth of gas. On the flip side of that, however, is you're going to be paying almost $400,000 more in interest over the life of the loan. That's almost the cost of the house you're trying to purchase. So you're paying much more over a longer period of time. You're trapped in debt longer. And even though you're saving in the short term, you're going to be paying so much more in the long term. And I don't think that's what people want at the end of the day. They don't want to be trapped in debt longer.
So people don't stay in their house usually for 50 years. I read that most people either move, downsize, or upsize on average around at the 12-year mark. So in that case, maybe a 50-year mortgage is an okay deal if you only stay in the house 12 years. What's that? How's that work out?
I think when we're talking about this conversation, we think, okay, my rate will probably be about 5%, 4%, maybe if rates continue to decline. Banks will need to charge a higher interest rate for your mortgage because they're going to operate under the assumption that you're going to be in that house for 50 years. So they're going to have to charge a higher interest rate, potentially as high as an extra point or a point and a half compared to a 30-year mortgage, because they have to hold that loan on their books longer. And a lot can happen over that 50 years. Perhaps a homeowner loses their job, they fall behind on payments. They need to take all of those risks into account. And 50 years is a very long time for a bank to have a mortgage on their books like that. So it might sound good, but at the end of the day, people are going to pay more in interest rates than they would normally on a 30-year mortgage and much more than they would on a 15-year mortgage.
Yeah. So what about the interest rates? If interest rates overall went down a point or two, wouldn't that also save a couple $100 a month on the mortgage payments?
It would. We also calculate that's another $200 or so a month if you were to refinance. But, refinancing costs money as well. So it's not just a free money to people. You have to pay thousands of dollars in order to refinance. Now, if you're a first-time home buyer, right, you're eligible for a number of federal programs that help you with a lower down payment. And as rates continue to decline, that'll mean more money in people's pockets. And that's why the president is making such a big push for the Federal Reserve to cut rates. Now, that's just on one side of the equation. How do we increase the housing supply? How do we build more housing, more apartments, more multifamily units? Unfortunately, there's not much the federal government can do in this regard. It's really these local governments, mostly in high-cost areas, that drive up the cost of housing with regulations and ridiculous rules that make it impossible or near impossible for builders to build. So when we talk about this national conversation, it's important, but the most important thing is we get it right at the local level. And I think that's where the next conversation needs to be.
Okay, so there's not enough houses to buy. So is that making them all more expensive?
It is. I mean, if you look at some of these areas, like, we all talk about, I'm from New York, right? So New York is an extremely expensive place, Los Angeles, Chicago. Why are those areas so expensive? Well, over the past 15, 20 years, they've put up so many more barriers to building. So it makes it harder for developers to come in, not only to make a profit, but also to just to build. In California, in Los Angeles, for example, you need parking minimums. For every unit of housing, you need to have a parking space. In some areas, you need to have electric vehicle chargers. 20% of all the parking has to be electric vehicle parking. So those are costs that get added on to builders. And then builders, they might say it's not economical for me to build here, or it's more expensive for them to build. And they have to pass those costs on to renters or home buyers. So it's all of these things that start to add up, right? These nickels and dimes, they do add up. And some areas have actually made an effort to reduce these barriers, and kudos to them for doing so. But there's so many jurisdictions that are just dragging their feet in order to do it, and it's really holding their economies back.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about whether the 50-year mortgage is a good idea with Tommy Aiello, Senior Director of Government Affairs with Taxpayers Union. Another thing that's being floated by the Trump administration is the idea of portable mortgages. Portable mortgages would allow homeowners to keep their existing interest rate and the terms of the loan instead of paying off the loan when if they go to get a new one. So this type of mortgage, it can be found in Canada. Other countries use it. Is it feasible in the U.S. market?
It remains to be seen if it's actually feasible. And again, the president and his team are coming from a good place. They're getting creative in how we come up with these solutions. A portable mortgage is interesting, and perhaps it's more feasible than the 50-year mortgage, but it's just really untested in the United States. There's a lot of reasons why why it could hold the market back, right? If you purchase a $400,000 home, maybe you lock in your interest rate of 4%. If you go to sell your home and you want to purchase a bigger home, maybe 15 years later, maybe at 700,000, you're only locked in on that interest rate on the first 400,000. So you're going to have to get another rate, a supplemental rate, to cover that additional balance. So it does lock in originally, but over time, if you do want to end up moving your house, you're going to have to pay a little bit more in a higher interest rates. So it really becomes this problem where it's okay in the short term, but it doesn't solve your problem in the long term because housing prices usually always go up. So it's a problem that's going to have to be solved by the administration if they do want to move forward with this.
So why does it work in Canada and other countries? Why wouldn't, what makes us different?
It's a little complicated, but we have a lot more financial plumbing in our housing market. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they are the ones that, purchase most of the mortgages. They repackage it into something called a mortgage-backed security, something we might remember from the 2008 financial crisis. It becomes much more tricky to package those types of mortgages if you have a portable mortgage rate. They really rely on these conventional mortgages that are your 15-year mortgages, your 30-year mortgages. So it becomes more complicated for the financial plumbing of our system to package up these portable mortgages and sell them off to different buyers. And why is that important, right? It sounds very complicated. Well, the buyers and sellers of these mortgage-backed securities are the liquidity that keeps our mortgage system running. It enables banks to move these mortgages off their books and make more loans to more buyers. More loans typically means lower rates for most people. So when you add this wrench into the system, we don't know exactly how it's going to turn out. And I think that's why you're seeing a lot of experts sort of pan this idea of a portable mortgage, because it could undo a lot of the foundations of our mortgage system. And we just don't know how the market would react to such a change.
We mentioned earlier, you know, affordability. We've talked about interest rates. We've talked about low housing stock as all as barriers to home ownership. Is there anything else standing in the way for people who want to buy a house that we haven't mentioned?
You know, when it comes to building homes, right, we mentioned how local governments are standing in the way, but there's also more the federal government can do, right? The president has imposed these massive import taxes, these tariffs on places like Canada, China, and Mexico. All of those places send goods to the United States that are integral for building housing, right? Canadian softwood lumber, almost all houses in the United States are built with softwood lumber. So if you tariff those things and appliances and copper for copper piping, it becomes more expensive to build. And when it becomes more expensive to build, those costs get added on to home buyers, which means their house becomes more expensive and they need to take out a bigger mortgage. And a bigger mortgage means more interest at the end of the day. So there's little things like that that are driving up home prices. And if the administration does want to bring home prices down, we think it would make sense to stop the tariff policy and reset back to where we were on January 20th before the tariffs.
Back to the 50-year mortgage for a minute. Would banks even want to take this on? Do banks want a 50-year mortgage?
Yeah, I mean, right? It's 50 years is a long time. That's that's 5 decades. And I don't think, you know, banks want to obviously make loans. That's how they make their money. And it could be attractive to them because they know they would make more interest, potentially double the amount of interest they would on a 30-year mortgage. So that from that perspective, it makes sense. But there's also risk involved with that, right? We touched on the fact that 50 years is a long time. A lot can happen in a person's life that could cause them to fall behind on their mortgage. And when you hold that 50-year mortgage on your books, it becomes extremely risky. And, you know, the 50-year mortgage, you might have to charge a higher interest rate than you would on a 30-year rate to account for that interest. So I think banks would be interested in offering the 50-year mortgage. I just don't know how much demand from a consumer side there would be for such a rate.
Obtaining mortgages is already a challenge for minorities. Would a 50-year mortgage be even more of a challenge, or would it be easier? I'm not sure.
You know, I'm not really sure either, to be honest with you. I mean, if you look across the board, right, it could be attractive for working class people because they know that they might save $250 on their monthly bill, or their monthly mortgage payment. That's a very big deal for a lot of people, and it would help them cover some of the more expensive goods and services that have skyrocketed over the past few years. And if you're taking that extra $250 and just applying it to your mortgage, making that extra mortgage payment every month, you know, maybe the interest wouldn't be as bad. But again, most people don't do that. Most people don't make those extra payments. They say they want to, but they don't. So I don't think it would impact minorities or other groups more than they would, but I don't know how it would impact them specifically.
Now, you mentioned earlier there's a lot of regulations before this could even be considered to go into effect. The Dodd-Frank Act that you mentioned earlier does not even allow for a mortgage to be longer than 30 years. So how do you change that?
Well, you'd have to go to Congress and change the law. And I think, you know, from what we're hearing from members of Congress on Capitol Hill, especially on the Republican side, is there's really not that much appetite to do anything here. I believe you had just, you know, 4 or 5 members of Congress tweet about it, that it was a bad idea on the Republican side. And that'll basically kill any chance of it actually moving forward. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't an appetite to do something on housing. In fact, the House Financial Services Committee, they're hosting a hearing in early December about the core drivers of housing costs. And this is a very bipartisan area. So you might see a few more bills introduced that are bipartisan to address the problem, particularly around land use policies and zoning at the local level, and making sure that localities that are receiving federal funds for affordable housing are actually changing some of their laws to build more housing. So it's little things like that that I think have more legs than they would with changing the laws to try and change it to allow a 50-year mortgage to be backed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
So just to end on, 50-year mortgage, good idea, bad idea? You know, what should we give up on this and be trying something else?
You know, I do think it's a creative idea, but we should really stick with the proven solutions that could drive down housing prices, right? That's, you know, land use, zoning reforms, reducing some of the tariffs, permitting reform at the federal level to build roads that go to these communities, and, you know, favorable tax policies. This is something that, every business responds to incentives. There were a lot of really good tax policies in the One Big Beautiful Bill that the president signed over the summer that'll spur more housing development. I read one recent report that said because of the passage of that bill, we'll be able to create 1 million more housing units over the next decade. It's a drop in the bucket for what we need, but it's real change. That'll actually help real people, hopefully over the next 10 years if those units were to come online. So it's little things like that that start to add up, and I think would actually make more of a sizable difference for people than a 50-year mortgage.
Our guest has been Tommy Aiello, Senior Director of Government Affairs with National Taxpayers Union. Tommy, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Coming up, Columbus Realtors are going to weigh in on the 50-year mortgage, and we'll talk about the local real estate market. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Last year, Realtor.com listed Columbus as America's most popular housing market. And while the market may be red hot, the path to home ownership has grown cold due to lack of housing stock and skyrocketing prices. The Trump administration is touting an idea of a 50-year mortgage as a means to make it easier for potential home buyers to purchase a home. We're talking about Columbus's real estate market and whether the 50-year mortgage is a good or bad idea for potential homeowners. Joining us now, we have Buffy Patterson, president of the Columbus Realtors Board of Directors. Welcome back to All Sides, Buffy.
Thank you for having me back.
And also taking a part in our conversation, we have Nate Kinkoff, producing branch manager for Neighborhood Loans. Welcome, Nate.
Thanks for having me.
So, Buffy, let's start with you. When you heard this idea floated of the 50-year mortgage, what did you think?
Well, honestly, Amy, my first thought was it does seem like a good idea. So when you think about it, if you spread your payments out over a longer period of time, your payments will be less, right? Mm-hmm. However, long term, it may not be the best strategy. Ultimately, a homeowner who would participate in this type of mortgage would pay more interest in the long term. Our median sales price right now in Central Ohio is $325,000. So if we just use that as a basis point, mm-hmm. that individual would end up paying twice as much in interest over 50 years, so about $700,000 more interest over that 50-year term. And so, sounds like a great idea, may not be a great idea in practice.
Nate, your business is loans. What did you think when you heard about the 50-year mortgage?
Yeah, absolutely. I was surprised that it was even floated as an idea. Something we focus on a lot with our home buyers is just the idea of financial literacy and what owning a home means long-term and short-term. And one of the biggest things about homeowners is they tend to have more net worth than renters by a large margin. And if you spread a loan out to 50 years and reduce how much they're paying down their principal, that whole principal kind of goes away. So for me, I like the idea of the way things are now versus financing hundreds of thousands of interest for a very short-term gain.
Buffy, what do you think of the idea of having a smaller monthly payment outweighing that length of the mortgage? Maybe people, if you're going to pay it for 50 years, then you're going to be done with the house. But, it doesn't matter if you have equity or not.
Well, but realistically, the savings are not that great. On a $325,000 home, mm-hmm. for example, if you didn't put any money down and your interest rate was around 6.25%, you're really only saving $100 to $200 per month. And so that $100 to $200 per month over 50 years, there may be a way to figure out how to make that up another way. So maybe save a little more before purchasing a home so that you can do the traditional mortgage. or cut back on some of your expenses. You know, we kind of were joking around before, maybe cut back on the coffee where you're spending your money.
Yeah.
But it's just $100 to $200 a month savings. And there may be another way to cover that and not to put yourself in a situation where you're paying so much interest over the long term. You're not gaining the financial, benefits of paying that mortgage down and reaping the long-term benefits in terms of your equity and your ability to do other things with that money in the future.
Well, Nate, I read in an article about this 50-year mortgage that it sounds like you're basically just renting from the bank, right? Which I guess is kind of what a mortgage is anyway, but now you're renting from a bank for 50 years. Do you see that as like you're not building equity, you're just renting from the bank?
I do. And you know, I see, just generally speaking, as we move further into the next generation of people, it's a dangerous slippery slope to me of kicking things down the road financially. We're in a world where you can finance Chipotle over four payments, right?
And things like that. That's true. I forgot about that.
I think when it comes to a home mortgage, taking the time to, like Buffy said, to find ulterior ways or different ways to go ahead and manipulate that payment. And you can do that on a 30-year loan with a little bit more cost up front. You can get the same payment that you might get on a 50-year loan traditionally. So there are ways to do it if you're talking to the right people and having a thorough conversation about your options.
As a lender, would you I'm assuming you charge more interest for a 30-year loan versus a 15, so you would need to charge higher interest rate for 50 due to the risk of that many years?
The spread from a 50 to a 30 would definitely be higher.
Okay. I mean, hypothetically, like what would, you know, what's a 15 right now for you versus 30, and what would you predict 50 would be?
Yeah, 15 years are about 0.75% to 1% lower than a 30.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot more data on those historically on how they perform and why that's the way that it is. So my assumption for a 50 year would be at least that spread, if not, you know, half a point to a full point. And at that level, the savings we've been talking about in this dialogue with everywhere are even less than people think they would be.
What about, Buffy, what about not actually having the mortgage for 50 years? Because I read that on average, a homeowner basically stays in their house for about 12 years, and then they either upsize, downsize, sell, you know, do whatever. So if you have a 50-year mortgage, but you're only staying there for 12 years, what does that matter?
Well, so the benefit to the difference, I should say, if you've got a 30-year versus a 50-year, you're in the house for 12 years. With a 30-year mortgage, you've paid down more of your principal. So the payment, the principal to interest payment is different with a 30-year mortgage than a 50-year mortgage. So with a 50-year mortgage, you may not have paid down much more than a couple thousand dollars on your mortgage. And so you don't have that gap in, you don't have that equity gap. So for instance, if I have a 300, we'll just stick with 325 since that's our median. And I say I'm going to sell my house 12 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
I may have paid down with a 30-year mortgage somewhere between $20,000 to $25,000 versus with a 50-year mortgage, I may have paid down $3,500 to $4,000. That $25,000 is money that I can use towards the purchase of my next home. Mm-hmm. And so having a 50-year mortgage, it just reduces flexibility in the long run.
So the 50-year mortgage, Nate, got a lot of buzz. You know, it made headlines. It sounds shiny and new, right? But from a loan perspective, what would you rather see if we're not going to do a 50-year mortgage? Does anything need to happen with the 15 or 30 that would make home buying easier?
Yes, it's a great question. I'm glad you asked that. It's really simpler. A lot of times answers to things like this to me are a lot simpler than people make them. The way to get cheaper payments or more affordable housing is to have lower financing rates or lower prices.
Hmm.
And if you look back to pre-COVID, to have the same type of affordability for housing today as we did then, you'd have to have incomes jump by 50% or houses prices cut by 25%. And neither of those things, I think, is likely to happen. So what a lot of people don't know about what goes on behind the scenes is there are most loans that are done are securitized or delivered by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are government agencies that help in the back end of this market. And they have guarantee fees and loan level pricing adjustments that go into every file. Basically, it gets passed on to the consumer. And they make sense to have, but if the administration or any policymaker wanted to overnight reduce interest rates by a half to a full percent, they could remove those sorts of fees that are passed through to the lender which ultimately get passed to the consumer instantly. And so that would be one thing that a lot of people in the banking world would love to see, obviously. they were initiated years ago for risk purposes, but you know, both of those agencies had $12 to $15 billion in profits last year, so they've sort of served their purpose as far as you know how that works. So that's one thing. And then the other thing would be, for me, is just helping with inventory. How do you motivate people who own houses that don't live in them to sell them, you know, to create more primary occupants? And that could be done with tax law. That could be done with, you know, incentivizing capital gains, things like that. But inventory and financing rates are the two things that really would help. Spreading a loan out 20 more years, to me, is not the answer.
All right. We'll talk more about inventory in a minute. But one more question about the 50-year mortgage from a loan officer perspective. What if, so if the median, I mentioned the median age of a first-time homebuyer is 40. If you get a 50-year mortgage, then you're 90. I mean, basically, you're going to be dead by the time. Like, how does that work? Would you only give a 50-year mortgage to a 20-year-old? I don't understand this.
Well, that's a great question. And so most mortgages are priced based on risk. The 30-year has, again, tons of data and data points to suggest why rates should be where they are. A 50-year does not, you know, as far as life expectancy, as far as people's ability to pay, the credit requirements you might put on that. So it may be ultimately a riskier loan to give and expect to pay the entire time. And if that's the case, it will be reflected in a higher interest rate. So,
all right. So should we end it with Buffy? 50-year mortgage is a nice, a shiny thing that'll get people talking about changes, but maybe that's not the change.
That may not be the change, I would say, for homeowners. Mm-hmm. There may be a segment that it could be good for, and that would be investors. Who are looking to...
Is that who we want to help?
Not necessarily, yeah. But cash, from a cash flow perspective. But for your average, everyday person out here who's trying to secure a home for their family and create a safe, you know, a safe space and to grow equity and to really realize the American dream, I would say it's probably not the answer.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we have been talking about the idea of a 50-year mortgage, and now we're going to pivot to the Columbus housing market. Still with us, we have Buffy Patterson, president of the Columbus Realtors Board of Directors, and Nate Kinkoff, producing branch manager for Neighborhood Loans. So, Buffy, Columbus is one of America's hottest housing markets. Would you say the status right now is still red hot? Because 2024, we were like the hottest market. Are we still right now here almost to the end of 2025?
We are. So sales are actually up in Central Ohio. You know, we were talking about inventory earlier. Inventory's up, but sales are also still increasing. And surprisingly, prices are increasing as well. So I'm going to say we're a little bit more than warm.
Maybe not red hot, but still hot. Okay. That's good news.
Yes.
But then the downside is what? There's more people looking for houses and they can't find them. So then they're more expensive.
No. So our inventory is actually up about 20% over year. So there are more options available for buyers. I think what's good about that is it gives buyers the opportunity to take time to make a decision about and to really find what it is that they want. So we've got inventory. It's out there and it's available. I think there's always that balance between, you know, prices and the rates. And so helping to get people what they want, where they want it, at the price that they want, I think is maybe where the challenge is.
And Nate, earlier you mentioned something interesting about inventory. I've done a lot of housing shows, and we always talk about the need to buy more housing, build more affordable housing, rehab old dilapidated housing. But you said that you need people who are just sitting on a house to sell it. That was interesting. Tell me more about that.
Well, when we're talking about first-time buyers, we're probably talking about the lower end of the price point for overall housing, right? And so when you look at a lot of new build spec builders around town, a lot of those houses start in the 400s. The joke now is like, yeah, today's entry-level house might be closer to 400. I remember when it was 200, right? So if we're trying to unlock more affordable inventory on the lower end of that range, typically that's held a lot of times by investors. And so we can motivate people like that to want to sell that. Again, there's policy and there's tax and there's ways to do that. That might open up more inventory than we need builders to build more, build faster, offer these crazy incentives that still maybe aren't moving the needle. So that's kind of what I was referring to.
What makes an investor want to hold on to a house? Like, I guess to change that, is it need to be like a local law? Is it a state law? Is it a federal law?
Yeah. I mean, I think if you look back, we don't get to where we are overnight, right? So a lot of what we're working through today is based on policy from 2020 and 2021 with regards to the Fed buying mortgage bonds, keeping rates low for a very, very long time. And at that moment, I don't think anybody was looking around thinking, boy, this is going to be a problem in 5 years. But now what you have in those situations is very low finance rates with people who can charge rent and make good money. And so we can't undo that, right? That's there. But can we incentivize them for any reason to sell? To maybe if you sell to a primary owner or a first-time buyer, maybe you get a tax credit or some reason to want to actually move that inventory. Because that, to me, is going to be the most affordable housing you're going to find. It's not necessarily going to be the $400,000 new build in Plain City.
And if I may, I do think it comes down to finding a way to the incentivization of to get someone to buy, and taxes are extremely important. That capital gains tax does stop a lot of investors from making those decisions.
Buffy, what drives the popularity of the Columbus real estate market? You said that, you know, we've been red hot. Mm-hmm. We're still hot, maybe not red hot, but still hot. Why is Columbus popular?
So there's so many reasons. We have several universities here. We have a ton of businesses that are, you know, top 50, top 100 businesses that attract people. We are very well located in terms of the ability to get from here to almost anywhere in the country within a 2-day time period. And so I think it's all of that, plus our housing, although it may seem unaffordable to some, we actually have a pretty affordable housing market here. The national average sales price is $415,000. We're at $329,000 here in Central Ohio. And so we are still an affordable place to live. We also don't have here the wild kind of swings in terms of, although it may feel like we have wild swings with our weather, but we don't have earthquakes. We don't tend to have tornadoes. We don't have hurricanes. So we're pretty insulated in terms of like weather related events. And so there's a lot, I think, that makes Central Ohio attractive. And then we're just like friendly and good people here too.
All right. Well, I did a show where I was talking with someone from the YWCA who was looking for rental places for people who need housing, right? And she was just very adamant. It's the president, Liz Brown. She was very adamant that we need more of a variety. She said that there's too many studio apartments or one bedroom apartments. We need like 3-bedroom apartments or something like that. Does that account for housing too? When people are looking to buy houses, do we have enough variety of the 2-bedroom, 3-bedroom, 4-bedroom?
I think we do have a ton of variety here in Central Ohio. And I actually used to sit on the YWCA's board, so I know Liz. Mm-hmm. I think from a rental perspective, she's right. Yeah. Typically what you're going to see, you don't see 3-bedroom apartments typically or 4-bedroom.
That's what she was meaning.
Apartments.
She needed a rental. Yeah. Yes. So we have plenty to buy in the 3-bedroom range.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's your typical is going to be a 3-bedroom, 1.5-bath. That's kind of the typical housing stock for older housing stock in the Central Ohio area.
Okay. And so do we have enough that are a little bit smaller than that, and a little bit bigger than that?
We have 2-bedrooms. You don't see many 1-bedrooms, but single family homes, we definitely have a variety. The importance though of, because we do need it all. We need larger homes, but we also need smaller homes. So the rise of ADUs, accessory dwelling units, townhomes, doubles, even the conversion of some formal rental units that may have been multifamily, so a two unit or a 3-unit, converting those to condominiums, that may be something else that we can encourage people to do to get a little bit more bang for their buck. But there are ways to achieve this. I think we just have to be creative. Look at what we have and be creative.
Nate, what are you seeing from a loan perspective of when people are trying to, you know, they're asking you for a loan? How much of a down payment does the average person have, bigger or smaller than a few years ago? What do people have whenever they're trying to buy the house down payment wise?
Yeah, a lot of our population in the last few years has been working with first time home buyers. So it might be a little bit skewed based on what my experience is. And in that sector, you're looking at 3 to 5 to maybe 10% down. It's very unusual that someone's going to put 20% down on a home. The reason folks used to try to do that was to not pay extra fees monthly, but those fees are a lot less now than they used to be. And even if they can, if they sit down and look at the payment difference versus what their money can do for them elsewhere, people generally put down what they can to get into the house and start building equity and have their cash as well. So I would say on average, probably that 5 to 7% is what we see for most first-time buyers.
Is there a certain amount that's needed, or that's not, there's no rule or law? I want to use the word law of how much you have to have.
Yeah. As a first-time buyer, 3% is the minimum. So okay. You have to have some skin in the game per se, unless you're a veteran where it could be 100% financed. Mm-hmm. And then as a non-first-time buyer, it's 5% down. So those are the down payments that you need to come up with. There are programs that can help with that have benefits and drawbacks to them. But if you're just doing a traditional loan and bringing your own money to the table, those are the minimums.
Who set that minimum? Is that the Dodd-Frank Act? Or
yeah, so that's based on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, again, who securitize all these loans. So you theoretically could see a private marketplace develop where they offer loans that are different than that, but they would have significantly higher costs. So yeah, Fannie and Freddie are set those guidelines that we all underwrite to.
Okay. Yep. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and our guests are staying with us. And listeners, if you bought or sold a home in the past year and want to tell us about your experience, you can join us, 614-292-8513, or send an email to allsides@wosu.org. Coming up, we're going to continue to talk about the Central Ohio real estate market when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides, and I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. According to Realtor.com, Columbus was America's most popular housing market in 2024, and that trend is continuing in 2025. Local home sales rose nearly 10% in October, and the median sale price increased by 3.2%. We're talking about the Central Ohio housing market this hour. Listeners, have you bought or sold a home in the past year? You can tell us about your experience at 614-292-8513 or send us an email at allsides@wosu.org. And still with us, we have Buffy Patterson, president of the Columbus Realtors Board of Directors. Thanks for being here, Buffy.
Thank you for having me.
And Nate Kinkoff, producing branch manager for Neighborhood Loans. Thanks for being here, Nate.
Great to be here.
And we had an email from Richard, and he asked, it's a two-part question. One question is for Nate, one's for Buffy. So we'll start with Nate. Richard's asking if this whole idea of the 50-year mortgage, it reminds him of a balloon loan of the past. What's a balloon loan?
Yeah, a balloon loan is where a lot of the payments initially are either interest only or very, very small, and then a big amount is due at the end, all at once. And products like that were very common pre-2007, 2008, before the financial crisis, and everything got revamped from that point when the government got involved rightfully and regulated a lot of what we can offer. So I think his point there is moving towards those sort of products where the homeowner is paying every month but not really hitting anything but interest is sort of akin back to products from before that obviously didn't serve the home buyer or the community well. So,
all right. And the second part of Richard's question is for Buffy. And he's asking, are we building too many apartments now and not enough single family homes? I guess Richard feels like when he's driving around, he sees a lot of apartments, not single family homes being built.
Well, I would definitely say that as you look at some of our busier corridors, there are more apartment buildings being built. I think a part of that has to do with the fact that we are expecting to see and are actually seeing that we will have, you know, a million plus more residents in Central Ohio within the next 25 years, and that not everyone will be a home owner. Mm-hmm. In addition to the fact that something you were talking about earlier, the new average age of a first-time home buyer is 40. Mm. And so people generally are going to either start out by, you know, staying at home with parents or family and then moving into their own apartment or single-family home, depending on what they choose to rent, and then moving into buying their first home.
So those 20 and 30 year olds need somewhere to live.
They do.
What do you think of the fact that the median age of a first time home buyer is 40? Because you wrote in a piece that came out mm-hmm. today that's up. It was 33 years old just 6 years ago. So mm-hmm. does that surprise you as 40 old for a first time home buyer?
It is a little surprising. I've been around a little bit, and back in the 90s, it was like in the mid 20s. So the age does continue to rise. I think a point Nate brought up earlier in terms of just, I don't know that it's possible for our incomes to increase enough to meet the level that prices have increased for new home, you know, for homes. Mm. And so surprising, yes. Is there something that we can do about it? Yes. And so no matter where you are in the spectrum, 20, 30, 40 or beyond, if you are interested in buying a home, there's some certain places where you need to start. I think first is to educate yourself from a financial perspective. You know, budgeting is very important. Understanding what your income is, what you can afford, and then working with someone, connecting with a realtor or a lender professional that can help you, A, understand your credit, understand your finances, and then work with you until you get to the point that you are able to buy. But not knowing where you stand is probably the worst thing that you can do. As early as you have the thought, you need to talk to someone so you can really figure out where you are.
And Nate, I know that you're not surprised that the first-time home buyer has risen to 40, because I saw a video that you did where you went around asking people what if they knew the average age of a first-time home buyer, and every single person you asked way underguessed it. So maybe you're not surprised, but everyone else is, right? Like, talk to me about this first-time home buyer being 40.
Yeah, for sure. And it's a lot of what I think Buffy talked about, but it's also nothing's in a vacuum, right? We zoom out and look at, you know, marriage rates and birth rates and things that are correlated to people needing to have housing, those are lower than they were 20 or 30 years ago. So naturally, the desire for maybe buying a house might not start till later or at all. And the other piece, the personal accountability standpoint of all of this is, and I'm 35, so this isn't like get off my lawn type thing here, but there is a choice to be made on saving and having a budget and having a plan versus just seeing what you can afford and then deciding not to do it. So if you want to buy a house for $400,000 or $500,000, it may be a 1-3 year plan that you're going to start to set aside money. And I think starting there and actually having a conversation to align yourself with that is a big deal that a lot of folks might not do, because no one's talking about that with them, right? In school or graduate college, any of that stuff.
How many young people come to you and think they can make it work, and then you sit down and show them the numbers and they suddenly realize, nope, I'm not buying a house today?
A good amount, mm-hmm. unfortunately. But at least that person in their 20s now understands what's going on. So they're much more likely to be a home buyer at 30 or 32 and not that 40, right? And they're getting that extra 8 to 10 years of building equity. So I think that happens a lot, but it's still a good conversation versus no conversation at all.
Buffy, you're the president of the Columbus Realtors Board of Directors, so you probably talk to a lot of real estate agents on the regular. Do they all see the first-time home buyers being 40? That must be a much different vibe for them than like 20 years ago if they're trying to sell a house to a bunch of 25-year-olds.
Definitely. Yeah. And it really just depends on when they got into the business. Yeah. Similar to like rates being, 3%, 4%.
Yeah.
I remember when interest rates were like 14%, and I know they were even higher than that. Mm. And so just depending on when you enter the profession, it may not be strange for the first person that you're working with to be in their late 30s, early 40s. But for those of us who have been around for a while, you're used to dealing with like a 25-year-old as a first-time home buyer, and now...
Well, if the median age is 40, that I find that just fascinating, because that means like some people are 35, mm-hmm. but some of them are like 55.
Yes.
Wow. Are there a bunch of 40 and 50 year olds renting right now, too?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And to work with someone who's in their 50s and it is their first time buying a home is the most rewarding. They're happy. They've got their whole families, with them celebrating, and they've done something that a lot of them don't think they could have ever done. It's very rewarding.
Are they getting a 30-year mortgage, though, at the age of 50?
Yes.
Okay.
Typically, yeah.
I don't, I'm doing too much math here. I'll just forget about it. Okay. One other thing I wanted to talk with you about, Buffy, is the desirable areas of Columbus to purchase a home, because you released your October housing report, mm-hmm. and you said that Southwestern City School District and Hilliard City Schools are where they're standing out for both volume and affordability. So why is that for those two?
Well, I think for one reason, the Hilliard City School District and Southwestern and the Hilliard area, the median home prices are actually less than the median for all of Central Ohio. I think around $307,000. And so attractive to, you know, pay a little less. And then people who have children typically are looking for school districts that are in alignment with, you know, their goals for their children. And so if it's a higher performing school district, they may, you know, look for that as well. So I think you get the benefit of both.
Are there areas of Central Ohio that you think have potential for future growth? Are we going to keep seeing it in Southwestern and Hilliard, or are there other areas?
Well, I think we are going to continue to see growth in the South, just because we are having, you know, companies like Anduril and mm-hmm. others come into the community. And so you're going to see people kind of move where the jobs are. And but there are other areas. A lot of our outside of 270 areas are growing, again, because we have industry coming in. And Central Ohio overall is just, it's an attractive place to be.
Yeah, your same October report specifically mentions Lancaster, Newark, mm-hmm. and Marion yes. as places people are moving to. Is that happening because there's more houses available, or because they're more affordable?
I think it's because they're more affordable. There aren't, I mean, if you think about just from a population standpoint and a growth standpoint, you know, you've got inside 270, and so we only have so much land, and there's only so many places where you can build a home. But outside of the 270, as we continue to spread and to grow as a region, more homes are being built. It is more affordable in some instances, and so people are moving to where they can get that affordability, but still be kind of close, you know, close to the larger city.
I wanted to pivot back to where we started, the 50-year mortgage idea, mm-hmm. just for the few minutes we have left. Earlier in the show, I talked with our previous guest about the difficulty for minorities obtaining a mortgage. Do you think, and he wasn't sure of the answer to this, do you think the 50-year mortgage would make it harder or easier for minorities to get approval? Do you want to take that, Nate?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't necessarily think it, we know now based on not knowing the terms that would come with that and the guidelines that would come with that as well, right? Because if they are more, if that longer term has different underwriting requirements, it might look differently. But again, I'll go back to that is putting the onus, and in my opinion, that's taking the future equity gain from the consumer versus addressing other areas of the financing costs. Like I mentioned earlier with the loan level price adjustments and some of the stuff that the government agencies do behind the scenes that could actually have a bigger impact on rates than anything else. So I think it's kind of a look over here while not looking over here type of thing, as far as like this is a good way to get in the house, but really it's not. I guess I'm being a little more direct about how I feel about it. But, I'll let Buffy go from there.
What do you think, is it harder for a minority to obtain a loan and buy a house?
I mean, I think historically it definitely has been, and mm-hmm. certainly that could continue if placed in a situation where it's not favorable, the conditions are not favorable to be able to obtain that mortgage, it is going to be harder.
Mm. Well, as we end here, we got an email from Brad, and he wants to know what the guests expect to see when it comes to interest rates in 2026. Brad is looking to refinance and is holding out hope. So, Nate, what do you think about interest rates for 2026? Do you have a crystal ball over there?
Yeah, my crystal ball is that every prediction that's been posted in the last 3 years about rates has been wrong.
Okay.
With that said, we're in between the 6 and 7.5 range for about 3 years now.
Okay.
So I think in that range is likely where we'll be. We have a little room to go lower right now, but I wouldn't expect them to be significantly lower than they are today, which is around 6.25. Unfortunately, I wish I could say otherwise, unless something dramatic happens.
All right. We're never going to see that 2% interest rate again.
Unless something dramatic happens. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So the 6 to 7% rate in 2026, do you think that they're going to keep bringing it down by like a little quarter of a point here and there?
Well, I think the Fed will continue to cut rates, but that, mm-hmm. again, another talking point that we go over with consumers is not directly going to impact mortgage rates. It's a different whole different marketplace.
Oh, so when Jerome Powell does something, you don't lower your rate?
No, it actually has sometimes has the inverse effect based on what investors do in the bond market. So if you have another hour, we can talk about mortgage-backed securities. But I would just say that the Fed will keep cutting rates, but it may not necessarily mean that mortgage rates are any lower in a few months than they are right now.
So when should Brad refinance?
Oh, when it pencils for him to do so. That's a question for everybody, right? Yeah. As far as what savings means to somebody. But most importantly, I'd go back to his original lender that he worked with, who's got a relationship with, and have them run the numbers for him as often as he wants.
All right. Well, we have been talking about the Central Ohio housing market, and we also were talking about whether the proposed 50-year mortgage is a good or bad idea. Thank you to Buffy Patterson, president of the Columbus Realtors Board of Directors. Thanks, Buffy.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you to Nate Kinkoff, producing branch manager for Neighborhood Loans. Thanks, Nate.
Thanks, Amy.
And you've been listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.